first story today from Steve Wiles. It's about one simple decision that turned out to be not so simple at all. Snap judgment.
From a young boy, all I remember of my father is how close we were, which is the irony, I suppose. We were very, very close. We were practically inseparable. The village we grew up in was a coal mining village. Most all the boys of my age, their fathers were all miners. It always seemed to be our destiny, even as small boys playing out on Colliery Row, or Pit Row as it was known locally. All through my young childhood, I was brought up on the understanding, rightly or wrongly, that my life would be spent down a coal mine. I expected, even the day I started work at the coal mine, I thought I'd be there for life. And I thought that any sons that I had would also be following me down the mine in a long-standing tradition. And I'd never contemplated doing anything else but coal mining. And I couldn't wait. You know, the minute we went down, that was an immensely proud moment for myself. I was with my dad. The miners at the pit used to call me. My dad's name was Ian, and the miners used to call me Young Ian because we were basically what we like two peas in a pod, which basically means we look identical. Yeah, I had a very high level of trust I had to have because my life would depend on it, and my co-workers' lives depended on it also. We had to watch each other's back. We were always aware that at any time there could be an incident, whether that be a roof fall, an explosion. The strike was beginning to be spoken about down the mine amongst the men. There'd been rumblings saying that the National Union of Mine Workers was going to ballot its members for a national strike, and we were all asked to assemble in the canteen. One of the union delegates was in there, and he told us that the government was planning to close 20 pits with a loss of 20,000 jobs, and he wanted a show of hands in favour of strike action. Union representatives said that the show of hands looked in favour for strike action. I disagreed with it, and I commented to the guy next to me. I said, well, I didn't think it was in favour of a strike, and he commented saying that he didn't think it was either. But nevertheless, there was a group of hardliners that decided they were going to picket the gates at that time. In the community, they have this moral obligation where you don't cross picket lines. That's bred into the socialist remit right from the get-go, really. And I was still living at home with my father then. When I went home the following morning, my dad was up. And I questioned my dad, who was a stalwart for the union. We was told there would be, at some point, a national ballot. And he said, we don't need a national ballot, we're out on strike, and that's it. Well, that's, to me, wasn't any good. That wasn't democracy. All he'd ever say was, you don't cross picket lines. He wouldn't even enter into a debate even about it. During the 6 months that I was actually off work and out on strike, my mind and my heart and my feelings were filled with nothing more than the strike. And my thoughts were that I was really against the strike. I needed to go back. It was just a matter of plucking the courage and the guts to actually pick the phone up and do it. My father made it clear. He told me, he said that no son of his is going to, no scab is going to live under his roof. That was the term he used. My dad's opinion is that if I'm going to continue working, I'm not welcome under his roof. It did play a heavy toll on my mind. I wasn't able to think about anything else, really. Part of the hesitation was how my relationship with my father would be, the feelings between me and my dad. It wasn't something I could just decide on a whim and do. It had a lot of consequence. And another part of it was the fear of retribution from the rest of the miners, bearing in mind in our local village, there'd be 500 or 600 people that actually worked at the mine. Every night, every lunchtime, every tea time on the local news, it'd be filled with nothing but people having bricks thrown through the windows, cars set on fire, even children attacked in some places just because the father had gone back to work.
The police knew the pickets would return with a vengeance today.
The number of men working here earlier this week was 16, but five men have stayed at home because, they say, three of their group were beaten up by pickets last night.
Police came under a hail of missiles from a group of miners. Burning barricades have appeared in rural Yorkshire to block access roads to pits. On two occasions, petrol bombs have been found. Since the strike began, the injury toll has topped 800.
It had been classed as a civil war by members of the government. They say it was a civil war at the time, and it was quite bloody. And to be fair, that's one thing that kept me from contacting the line. Anybody that wanted to contact the management, we had a direct line number anyway. Or so it was led to believe, that we had a direct line number, but it went through a switchboard, and that switchboard was monitored by, sympathisers to the strike. So anybody that contacted the coal mine, that their names were passed on to the National Union of Mine Workers leadership locally. So it was well known who was contacting the mines beforehand. I decided to go back to work, albeit 6 months into the main strike, because I waited for a national ballot, as did a lot of other people, because that's what our rule book said. You know, if that ballot had been in favour for strike action, like it or lump it, we would have been out on strike, because that is democracy. And we never actually got it. It never came. Once that decision was made, I went into the hallway where the telephone was, and I got the number for the pit, the mine. And I was asked what my name was. Who was speaking, please? So I told him it was Stephen Wiles. Do you want a secure line? So I said, well, yes, I suppose so. So he rang me back. I said, like, Gaffer, I want to come back to work. I've been against the strike from the start. And I was surprised when he said, well, we're aware of the situation with your father, but we can get you into the mine if you want to come in. But you can't just walk in. Obviously, it's not safe. We'll have to arrange for the police to contact you as regards being escorted in. So at that, we ended the call. And that's when, I mean, my hand was shaking holding the phone, but after I put the phone down, the feeling, I mean, I felt physically sick, because now I've done it, there's no going back now. I've got to follow it through, even if I have a change of heart later. Because, I mean, I was scared stiff. I'd seen the images on the news. I wasn't naive. I knew what the outcome could possibly be. Going to bed the night before, knowing that I was going to be picked up the following morning by the escorted bus, my head was all over the place. I'd got what we call collie wobbles, really feeling nervous and tense. And every time I opened my eyes, it hit me like a brick. You know, oh, crikey, in the morning, things are going to change, probably for the worst. I got up at the crack of dawn, something like 4 o'clock. Baked egg and beans is the last thing that I was wanting at that particular time, I can tell you. I didn't really want anything. I wanted to be able to keep it down if I had. At 5:15, there was a knock at the door. Opened the door and there's two policemen there, and there was quite a few policemen behind him as well on the pathway. I can tell you, I can feel it now just even recalling it. It felt like I went to the gallows. It really did. 'Cause the pathway was probably 25, 30 feet long to the gate. And I can't recall hearing any other noises at all. It was all like slow motion. A police van pulled up outside the house, followed by the bus, which was covered with weld mesh all the way around the windows. And then behind it was another police van. And this bus pulled up, the front sliding doors opened, and that's where I saw the driver and his mate stood at the front of the bus. Both had got crash helmets on, which really, I mean, that alone frightened me. But the man that was actually stood at the front, his assistant, had got a baseball bat in his hand. And what he said, I'll be with me for the rest of my days, I think. He said, if ever the bus gets overrun, there are baseball bats in the racks above your head. Well, that kind of really got my heart racing. But I never felt I'd done the wrong thing. It's just, I knew I'd done the right thing. It was just getting through it. The route the bus was taking was about 2.5 miles. Going down the final lane towards the pit bridge, the driver shouted down that it looks like it's a big turnout today, lads. And that quarter of a mile was lined either side, 5 deep, with miners, all screaming and shouting.
The miners were attempting to block the access road to the pit.
With just one row of policemen. The terminology, thin blue line, really played a part there. All linked arm in arm, holding these crowds back from overrunning the bus. They were chanting mainly scab, scab is the main word. All of us on the bus, we were together, but the nearest way I can describe it is like zombies, if you like. We were just sat staring into space, thinking of what we'd done, what we were doing, and what it had meant, and how our life has changed, and wondering, in fact, more than anything, wondering, would it ever get back to normal? Would life ever get back to normal before the, is it like it was before the strike? You know that most of the village and other villages, outlying villages around you, are baying for your life. I saw my father because he was stood right next to the pit gates, and he was looking at the bus, and he was shouting along with the rest of them. He knew I was on that bus. When I first saw my father on the picket line, that really, you know, I thought, well, we're divided really by the thin walls of a bus, but in reality, we're divided by life itself and by a lot thicker wall than that. But I still had, I mean, I loved my dad. I never stopped loving him. But I saw him and I thought, this is going to hurt him, not only because his son's gone back, but be a little bit embarrassing for him as well. I took that bus to that picket line every day for 6 months. You know, I mean, during the strike, obviously, I was a prisoner in the home. We had a brick through the window in the dead of night. I had a death threat at the letterbox. I was the 14th one to go back. And by, I would say, the Christmas of 84, there would be, at best guess, probably about 70 or 80 people back by then. And between Christmas and March, when the strike finished, they were coming back in droves. So it was practically 80% actually inside the colliery by the time the strike had finished. When the strike was called off by the union leader, yeah, we were quite apprehensive at that, because although 80% of the workforce had come back, the rest of them was going to come back, and they were the diehards. But when the elk came back, they come marching over the bridge with the union banner, brass band playing. You know, we were certain, just looking at them, that they were angry. They felt betrayed. And one of the first people that came through into there was my dad. I saw him, and that is the closest I'd stood to him for 6 months. I did look at him in the face, and I made a point of doing that. He looked at me, but he didn't, if you know what I mean. He kind of looked straight through me. He just refused to have anything to do with me. The funny thing, really, even after the strike had finished, my dad became a councillor in his local village, and some of the people that would go and see him were people that had actually gone back to work at the pit. And he spoke to them as if nothing had ever happened. It was just as friendly with them then as it was before the strike. And I know it would have hurt more from me because I was his son. But I always thought, you know, give it a month or two, then my dad will come round and we'll start talking, and life will get back to normal. As the months went by, it became clear that it was going to take a lot longer. So months turned into years, years turned into decades, and still his resolve was the same, that he wouldn't have anything to do with me. Well, I remember getting a call on my mobile phone in the office at work, and I think I knew. And then it was my sister saying, unfortunately, Dad passed away in the early hours of this morning. He died on a Tuesday, and he spoke to my sister on the Sunday, saying that he's got very little time left on this earth. He felt that he was going to pass away in the next few days, and started telling her what arrangements he wanted. But he never, in all that time, he was certain he was going, but he never actually said anything, mentioned my name. And I said, you know what? I lost my dad 30 years ago, essentially, because of me making that decision to go back to work. I couldn't say at all that I ever stopped loving my dad. I didn't stop loving him, even though that love was one-sided. Up to the day he died, if he'd knocked on my door and said, look, let's put it behind us and move on, I would have done that willingly. That brought an end to it, really. Not an end I would have liked. The strike crucified the coaling industry in the UK. The government just rapidly sped up the closure programme, and it turned out to be more, not just 20 as it was initially, it went to 70, and then pits were closing every year. When the mine closed, everybody drifted off. Some, sadly, never worked again, like my dad. The village died along with the coal mine. I remember I went back to the village in 2004. I actually went to visit the old pit row where I was brought up, just for nostalgia and just to reminisce a little bit. There's still a couple of miners live on there. And I got out the car outside what was my dad's house. It was a cold morning, because I remember seeing my breath, so it was a frosty morning. And just reminiscing what I used to do and coming out to the end of the yard as a young boy and playing in the dirt on the roadsides there. And that's when I noticed this old guy come out from a couple of doors down. And he stood at the end of his yard and he saw me. And he must have recognised me straight away. And I looked at him and he looked straight at me and he says, what are you doing here, you scab?
Find out more about Steve's story and a link to a book he wrote about his life, A Scab Is No Son of Mine, on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Anna Sussman, with sound design by Leon Morimoto.